Hello and welcome to a new interview from MinMax. MinMax is a place about games, friends, and getting better. My name is Ben Hansen. Thank you for being here. Thank you for clicking on this. This is an interview with Mark Healy, who is the co-founder of Media Molecule, the creative director for Dreams. And he has had a wild career, going back to working with Peter Molyneux in the 90s at Bullfrog on games like Theme Park, Magic Carpet, Dungeon Keeper, working at Lionhead on Black and White and Fable, before creating Little Big Planet and Dreams at Media Molecule. In this interview, we walk through his wild career of situations like being the first indie game released on Steam with Ragdoll Kung Fu, how Valve was trying to court the creators of Little Big Planet to be Valve employees before creating their new studio, how Microsoft lightly tried to get the Little Big Planet franchise from Sony in its development, and Mark shares his thoughts on Dreams in retrospect, regrets along the way, whether or not a PC version would have helped boost that to a Roblox level stratosphere hit. But without further ado, here's Mark Healy. Mark Healy, welcome to MinMax, sir.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, doing really well. Thanks for being here, man. What does your life look like these days, 1 year after leaving Media Molecule?
God, what does my life look like? It looks like this room, I suppose.
Yeah, for audio listeners, it's a bunch of instruments. It seems like a peaceful room. I mean, if you got to spend some time in a room, that seems like a good one.
Yeah, this is my man cave. This is where all my toys are and where I spend most of my time working now, actually. What am I doing? I've been very slowly working on my own project, a new personal project.
Interesting, okay.
Which has involved me sort of going back to my roots and, you know, getting involved, very hands dirty, programming, art, this kind of thing. So I'm learning, spent a lot of time last year just learning a bunch of new tools, actually, like Blender, getting into the nitty gritty of how to do online stuff in Unity, for example.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, but very unpressured, if you like. I'm not in the mode of like wanting to do a big startup again and get a big team or any of this kind of stuff. I'm at a situation in my life now where I can, I can afford to support myself for a few years and not worry about working really,
right,
which is very fortunate. So I'm like, well, I'll, you know, take advantage of that and actually make something that I really want to make and not really have to answer to anyone. You know, I can, make up as I go along, change direction as I please, and do something that really sort of, you know, means something to me, and the target audience being myself, essentially.
Yeah. There's something kind of funny about the creative director for Dreams being like, all right, now I need to learn some new tools of game development. Let me sit down and learn Unity. That's bizarre to hear.
Obviously for a long time at Media Molecule, Dreams was the sort of, everything we did was using the Dreams tools themselves, really.
Yeah.
I was quite familiar with Unity already because I used to actually prototype a lot of stuff in that anyway. But the online side of things and that, I didn't really have a clue. So I thought, let's dive into that, see if I can get something working. It's nice just to sort of, like, I'm going to indulge myself and, you know, I can do something that's completely left field and wacky and not really worry about whether it, you know, hits all the right data points and the target demographics and all this kind of stuff that you're forced to be enslaved to when you're in a sort of more corporate kind of structure. So I'm like, I'm going to, you know, indulge myself, basically.
And so at some point you'll release this smaller project and it's going to be then just like on Steam as the second game from Mark Healy on Steam and the last one being Ragdoll Kung Fu in 2005?
Possibly. I don't know. I mean, The thing that I find is when you actually start doing these things, other things happen. You know, there's been quite a lot of people get in touch with me from like various investors and other startups that have been
really
in trying to entice me and sort of mostly politely declined, actually. But weirdly, they sort of keep cropping up and they all seem to be interlinked with each other. So maybe it'll all come together somehow in some big mega project again. I don't know. But the point is, it's I'm just really allowing myself just to sort of float in the sea of it all. And I'm doing stuff, but I'm also sort of being dragged along by things that happen. So it's really, you know, it's really exciting.
Yeah.
And you know, the other thing that I'm doing as well, actually, is I am actually doing some freelance work for that I'm working on a top secret project, I suppose. I shouldn't say anything about it, but with an old, really old friend of mine that I've made many games with in the past. And that was really just like, oh, I like what you're doing. I can help out there. And that's kind of turned into, you know, sort of spending quite a few days a week actually helping out on that, really. And it's a really good opportunity for me to get my hands dirty again and learn. You know, I'm doing lots of things from coding to writing shaders to animating. And it's kind of forcing me to learn the stuff that I need to learn for my own project, which is really cool. So that's going on as well. So that's going to be quite exciting when that is announced, I think. That's actually looking really cool.
And imagine a lot of indie developers watching this are like, what a life where you just are working and tinkering on your own projects and people are just constantly reaching out to you and trying to offer you money. Like, what is going on in this investment community?
It's not quite as intense as that, but there's been a few people that just got in touch from, investors essentially that were keen to sort of get involved in any new startup that I might do, which is very flattering. Obviously, it's really cool. But I've kept a dialogue with those people because they seem like nice people, and you know, I figure it's good to sort of keep my foot in the door there in case I do want some help in the future. But now I'm very adamant that I don't want anyone having any kind of power over me at the moment. It's like, because the minute you take money off someone, suddenly I feel like really obliged to keep them fed with stuff, and I'd be reluctant to change my mind about what I'm doing because they'd probably get nervous. So I'm like, no, I don't really want to get anyone involved until it's very clear what it is I'm making. And at the moment, I'm just enjoying experimenting and sort of making things up as I go along. I'm very fortunate position to be in to do that. But I figure I can. So I sort of owe it to the universe to do that, really.
I mean, after 17 years at Media Molecule, that's what you're craving is, I don't want anybody telling me what to do. I don't want any financial pressure. I don't want to have to support people below me. I just want to go off and do my own thing and get my hands dirty.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, I'm not getting any younger. If I'm lucky, I've maybe got another 20 years on this planet or something. So I'm, you know, I owe it to myself to do something that really means something to me. And, you know, when you're working in a more, you know, well, Media Molecule, when we started, obviously we were a smaller indie team, really. But as we got more entrenched into Sony, there's more pressure to sort of, you know, make the money people less nervous about what you're doing. And because obviously we spent a long time on Dreams.
Yeah.
That was a mega ambitious project. I'm really proud that we managed to make that happen, actually. But obviously it wasn't the huge financial success that it kind of needed to be, really, to justify the amount of time we spent on it. And so there was a lot more pressure to do something new that was a bit more safe, I would say, which is, you know, not my cup of tea. So,
yeah. Well, why did you end up leaving after so many years?
It was, you know, I had been there a long time, 17 years. And, you know, we did Little Big Planet 1 and 2. And the dynamic then was very different. It was, you know, very much, obviously we did have the concept of producers and executive producers and things, but I would argue that it was led by the creators and the artists, really. And then, sort of towards the end of Media Molecule, I feel like that dynamic changed quite a lot, I would argue. So there was a lot more having to sort of justify things and look at data and work out, you know, the kind of stuff that big corporations have to do, really, because they're spending so much money on stuff. So I understand that. I don't hold it against anyone or anything, but it's just not my cup of tea, really. I started to feel a bit like just not enjoying myself anymore. So it's time for me to move aside, let the people that care about and enjoy that kind of stuff get on with it, and I'll go and go back to being this crazy dude who's going to make stuff that probably offends everyone in the universe.
It's an interesting strategy for life, I suppose. It's interesting to hear you talk about, like, you know, executive producers, money people running the show by the end there. The last game you guys released was Dreams. I mean, it's one of the wildest games ever. It looks like for the corporate oversight, like, good Lord, that's not so bad.
I mean, I think that's the thing. The Little Big Planet obviously gave us a lot of rope because that was incredibly successful. especially for such a small team that we were at the time. And, you know, that gave Sony the confidence to give us a lot of rope and just go off and do our own thing, really, which is exactly what we did. But, you know, it came to a point, I guess, where it's like, okay, well, you know, that was fun, kind of, and it's cool. You know, it's touched a lot of people, but it's just, it wasn't really, there was a lot of mistakes that we made, I would say, with it, especially it being a console game. So I think, you know, now the pressure was on to do something that people can have a bit more faith in on a console, I suppose. I mean, I have to be careful what I say, actually, because I might get dragged into saying things I don't want to say. But yeah, it's just, I 17 years of that kind of thing was enough for me. It was like time to move on. Sometimes, you know, it's just time to move on, don't you? So that's what I did. It was the cosmos, I think, just different things happen at the same time and coincide, and it's just like, this isn't any one particular person's fault that this has happened. It's just time for me to move on, you know.
Yeah,
it was simple as that, really.
I mean, do you in a time travel-y perfect world, would you go back and focus on PC development for Dreams, make that the primary platform?
It was definitely more suited to PC, actually. Yeah, it's a real shame that we never got to go follow through with the PC version, because that's obviously more suited to it, I think. I suppose the thing that I probably regret most about it was not integrating multiplayer online from the start. I think that would have made a big difference. And it was always intended that we would add that, and in fact we were in the process of doing that, but yeah, it just wasn't to be, unfortunately. But you know, if you look at things like Roblox, obviously, and or Fortnite even, you know, I don't think they'd really work without their online element. And, you know, that's what Dreams was really missing, in my opinion. So I think that's the biggest regret. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so you're working towards it, but just not enough of a runway in front of you to make it happen.
Yeah, those things happened. Things happened, basically. And sadly, it didn't get to see the light of day. You know, we had it working. We had the sort of basics of it actually working and stuff. But, you know, with most game development, you can sort of make what feels like a lot of progress very quickly, but then tying up all the loose ends and actually making it into something that's releasable takes a shocking amount of time, unfortunately. So, and we just didn't have that rope anymore, is my perception of it. Someone else might tell a different story, but that's, you know, that was what it felt like to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's fair. I mean, it's the team over there did such an amazing job. I love Media Molecule. I love Dreams. Try to champion as much as possible because it's a fascinating, awesome project that got out there in the world. I mean, I think I'm speaking for some Media Molecule fans of like that. It's such a talented team over there. Obviously, still there's some people that left, but still there's so much unbelievable talent. But I think there's a general feeling of just kind of worrying about them. We love the fact that every once in a while we could just look over and be like, oh, thank God Media Molecule is still pumping out some weird stuff. They feel kind of immune from the pressures of the larger game industry. And I know on the inside, I'm sure you're all running around with your hair on fire to make it happen. But should we be worried? Do you have a message for fans of Media Molecule out there about just like the future of that studio?
I think it's in good hands now. You know, obviously, I mean, I don't know exactly what state their project is in now that they're making. You know, I don't think it's secret news that they are working on a new IP, for example. And, you know, it's, I would dare to go as far as saying it's more of a game than a creative tool, for sure, from what I understand about it. So I think, you know, the Sony have still got a lot of faith in Media Molecule, so I'm sure at the very least they're going to get to make this game and hopefully, you know, hit, get back into the money-making books again, let's say.
Yeah.
So, and you know, I've got a lot of faith in the people that are still there. I think there's some amazing people. You know, I'm still in touch with a lot of them. So it's, I wouldn't worry too much. But then again, take everything I say with a pinch of salt, because, you know, it has been pretty crazy times the last few years, hasn't it, for the games industry. It's been a lot of big layoffs. obviously, you know, Sony London studio got completely shut down, didn't it?
Yeah.
And again, I'd already left by then, so I'm not party to any of the ins and outs of that, but I can imagine in some boardroom somewhere, it was probably a bit of a choice between Media Molecule and London studio. Who knows? So yeah, you know, fingers crossed they get to at least try and get this game out. I'm sure they will.
Yeah, that's great. To get you in a fully reflective mood here, do you like looking on your own past? I mean, you know, you still love tinkering on Commodore 64 projects. Is it nostalgia for those days of game development, or just for those tool sets in particular? Do you like looking in the rearview mirror here?
Hey, look, it's fun. I mean, funnily enough, actually, I went to the pub last night. There's in Guildford, which is just up the road, and that's where Media Molecule and lots of other games companies exist. You know, it's like England's little Silicon Valley, if you like. There's a little get together once a month with Guildford game developers. So I just rocked up there and saw quite a few old faces that I've worked with in the past at various companies. And it's inevitable we end up talking about, you know, the good old days and various things that we got up to and all that. So no, it's fun. I like to do that. And actually, the project that I'm, my personal project is actually all about that, if you like. It's all about sort of, how could I say it? It's like a big kind of tribute to history and nostalgia and the past and a sort of respect, if you like, for the history of computer games and art and lots of things, and old people as well, like myself.
Finally, let's celebrate some old people. In kind of a documentary sense, or more just it's a throwback experience and you want to give the vibes of kind of the history?
Yeah, again, take anything I say with a pinch of salt, because I'm liable to change my mind every 2 seconds, but I've been quite consistent with this in terms of how it's building up in my head. And certainly from a sort of... you know, if there's a narrative that I'd want to build into it, it is very much about how a lot of stuff that we do today is built on the past. And, you know, as just a sort of respect, if you like, for art and artists of the past, going, you know, right back to sort of like Renaissance type things and even ancient Rome and Greek and all this sort of stuff. So there's a lot of exciting ways that I can sort of integrate that into the narrative, but also the kind of visuals and the general theme of what you're actually doing in the game. I mean, there's a PC game that I really loved, actually. It came out a few years ago now. Procession to Calvary, I think it was called. Who's it made by? A guy called Joe Richards, something like this. Sorry, I forget his name. But so it's like a point-and-click adventure game, really. Fairly standard, if you like, in its mechanics and things like that. But what I really loved about it was the art style is all literally Renaissance painting, art and paintings. It's literally like taking Renaissance art and just kind of chopped it all up and animated it in a very sort of Monty Python, Terry Gilliam kind of style. And I love the humour in it, but I just also love the idea that he's taken that actual kind of art from the past and sort of remixed it and done this really funny stuff with it. So that's really inspired me for what I'm going to do with my thing, actually.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And I'm not accusing you of being an egomaniac, but it is interesting that the theme of this project is kind of like, oh, connecting the roots of art, even if that's going back to the Renaissance or going back to Bullfrog, just like appreciating where these things came from.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, when I talk to people that are a similar age to me, you know, I'm early 50s now, that have kind of grown up with the games industry, which, you know, kind of began when I was a teenager in my mind. There's, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia that we sort of, like, you know, I've got an arcade cabinet upstairs that's got like, you know, it's got an emulator thing in it. I think I've literally got like 100,000 games on it or something. It's basically the history of computer games in an arcade cabinet, everything from the, you know, really early Atari games and the arcade games up to about PlayStation 2 era or something like this. So it's fascinating just sort of delving through that and looking at some really old games and things. Probably spend more time playing those games than I do modern games, if I'm honest with you. So Yeah, I don't know. There's a. It's hard to resist being that old man that wants to talk about steam trains and the good old days and things. And I just really like the idea of, you know, sort of integrating that into a game experience, because I think it would appeal to me, and possibly appeal to people that are, you know, similar age to me. Hopefully, some younger people as well. Who knows?
Yeah. Do you have a period of your career that you think about the most? Maybe it's like the most exciting period of your career.
You know, if I'm, I'd like to say to myself now, really, because I am really excited about what's happening around me and what's going on. But I also do look back at lots of things, probably with rosy specs, because there was, you know, the reality there's always stresses and trials and tribulations and things. But you know, certainly the very first early years when I was getting into computer games, the Commodore 64. I don't know if your viewers would even know what that is now, but it's that was my first love, if you like. I got a Commodore 64 for Christmas in like, God, it would have been like 1983 or 4 or something like this. And you know, I was hooked straight away. I was like, wow, I can make things move on the television. This is like magic, you know? And that was when I really felt the excitement that I felt back then is something that's kind of stayed with me, if you like. And was actually a big inspiration for things like Little Big Planet and Dreams, to be honest with you, because it was all, you know, the joy that I used to get or still get from making stuff and sharing it with people and them reacting to it, and makes you feel like a magician in some ways. So, you know, Little Big Planet and Dreams was very much about sort of like other people can experience that as well without having to, you know, learn all that really annoying stuff like programming and blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, so I'd say definitely those early, the sort of 80s, 90s, I've obviously got a lot of fond memories, for sure.
Yeah, I found an old interview with Peter Molyneux, who you worked with for, what, I mean, a decade? How long were you working with Peter Molyneux?
Oh, yeah, God. I think I actually tried to write down some dates here because I always forget. But so I went to Bullfrog in 93, 94, I think, was when I started at Bullfrog. And then I was probably there until about 2005, 2006 or something. So, yeah, a good 10 years at least.
Okay, Bullfrog to Lionhead, that was the transition.
Yeah, yeah, that was by Peter Molyneux. I really got on with Peter. I still hang out with him now. And, yeah, that was a brilliant period, actually, because up until then, you know, I'd been doing Commodore 64 and some Amiga, Atari ST kind of stuff, but it was always very... you know, it was based on my passion for doing it. I wasn't really getting paid very well, and often I wouldn't get paid at all. But when I went to Bullfrog, it was the first time I felt like I actually had a proper job in the games industry. I was getting like paid every month, and I had a pension and all these weird things. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I'm getting, you know, I can actually commit to renting an apartment and still carry on doing what I love doing. So, and, you know, there's a lot of people that I'm still friends with now that I met back then that were, you know, really cool people, did some really cool stuff. And, you know, some of those people have gone on to do, you know, phenomenal things. You've got like, you know, I even got to work with Demis, for example, who founded Google DeepMind, who's now like, you know, mega Tyrell Corporation kind of boss dude. Obviously, Alex Evans, who's, you know, I formed Media Molecule with, you know, Kareem, and just all these really amazing people. Jonty Barnes was a really good friend of mine for a long time, who ended up being, you know, big dude at Bungie for a long time. So, yeah, I just feel so fortunate, really, that I got to sort of, you know, mix and kind of collaborate with these just amazing people. So
I found an old Molyneux interview where he's talking about the development of Black and White, and how apparently at some point he really insisted that the giant creatures should have realistic genitals on them. And Peter Molyneux said, quote, in this old IGN podcast, "The artist that modeled the genitals ended up going completely insane. He threatened to knife me. Absolutely true story. He went on to found Media Molecule, a chap named Mark Healy."
God, I never threatened to knife him. God, he likes to exaggerate. He gets so excited.
Peter Molyneux? I think he must be mistaken.
No, well, you know, he gets very excited. He loves what he does. But no, I never threatened to knife anyone. But I did go a bit. It's true that I did go a bit mad, actually. Well, I can see how in other people's eyes I probably went mad. I did have a bit of a yeah, there was a very strange period in my life when I was I won't talk about it too much because everyone will think I'm mad. But I actually did have this. Basically, I really messed my back up. Okay, I really hurt my back. I had a couple of slip discs, and anyone that's ever had that will know how horrible that is. It's incredibly, you're just in agony all the time. And it, you know, it can send you on a bit of a soul searching mission. And so it kind of, you know, it's a heavy on the soul, I would say. And I actually got in search of a cure, if you like. You know, I went through everything from chiropractors, to physios. Because the thing is, I was quite young, actually, when it happened to me. I was like early 20s. And the sort of doctors wouldn't even believe me that I was in so much pain. They're like, you're too young to have a slip disc. You know, just take some painkillers, it'll go away. And it didn't. And I actually went on a complete mission to learn about backs, and I even became a Reiki master, which is like a sort of hands-on healing art where you channel energy and all this kind of stuff. And actually, that it ended up having some quite profound effects on me, I have to say. To cut a long story short, I had this real kind of mad experience where I sort of had a... I think the technical term for it is like a kundalini awakening or something. I didn't know that at the time, but when I looked back after the event, that seemed to fit what happened to me. And it's a sort of like a I don't know, it sounds so crass and cheesy really, but it was almost like a reboot, like I felt like a born again kind of. I'm not religious at all or anything, sure. But when I see people having their born again experience and things, it was very much like that. And I remember going into work the next day, like, you know, it's like I'd taken some mushrooms or something. My eyes were like, zing! And people are like, oh my God, what's happened to you? And I was just like, oh, I feel like I woke up last night. And basically, I think because I wasn't really prepared for what had happened to me in terms of any kind of, you know, spiritual training or energy work or whatever you'd want to call this kind of stuff, it did start to send me a little bit mad because I was, you know, sensing very strange things. Like, you know, I could see lots of colours around people, and if you've ever done any sort of psychedelic drugs or anything like that, I'm sure you haven't, but you might know some people that have. You know, your senses go a bit crazy, and you can sort of become very empathic towards people, and you can pick up on things that you wouldn't normally pick up on. And basically, it got stronger and stronger, and I did end up feeling a bit crazy because I just wasn't really ready for that kind of experience in my life, I don't think. So that'll be what Peter was talking about, I imagine.
And so that was when you were developing Black and White. Do you think that had a tangible impact on the development of Black and White from your perspective?
I remember it sort of came to a head one day, actually, and it was basically, it got to the point, I mean, that in their minds, I probably hadn't, that I heard a nervous breakdown, maybe what it was, but okay. For me, it felt like a complete spiritual awakening, actually. And I just felt like I was in tune with the universe and I understood my place in the world. But it was very hard to explain that to people because they think you're just mad. And I probably was a little bit mad, but it's something that stayed with me. And I remember I thought, okay, I'm just going to take some time off work. Went back to see my family in Ipswich and met with some people, and I was really in the clouds, I suppose. I was actually, it was almost like being really high on mushrooms or LSD or something like this, but it wasn't anything to do with anything like that. It was just this weird, I think because I've been doing so much of this energy work with the Reiki, and I'd also started doing a martial art called Wing Chun Kung Fu, which doesn't sound like something that's very compatible with back problems, but I wasn't doing a lot of fighting. I was doing a lot of what you call the forms, which are sort of like, you know,
breathing and
breathing Carthas, is sort of like moving meditations, if you like, and it just it builds up lots of energy in you. And I got the thing that induced that experience, I think, was me just unblocking myself and having this real kind of epiphany, which was actually a big inspiration behind Ragdoll Kung Fu, funnily enough. You know, right. There's all the, you know, maybe it looks cheesy, but all the chi pa and all that kind of thing actually meant a lot to me at the time, because it was something that I was actually personally going through and experience. So I can't believe I'm talking about this stuff, actually. You've sort of dragged this out of me.
Now, it's interesting to think of, like, you know, I don't know, maybe it was the best working environment possible, but I'd imagine those hours, in those days, you're putting in a lot of hours working on stuff at Lionhead. And so I'm imagining you having this religious epiphany / nervous breakdown amidst probably a lot of crunch and overtime trying to ship a game as ambitious as Black and White.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, to be honest with you, I was always quite reluctant to do any crunching or anything. And I was quite, I had the confidence to say no, essentially. And a lot of, you know, there was a lot of people around me that were crunching and doing lots of long hours. But, you know, for me, I could see that it was counterproductive to do that kind of effort, really. You end up actually slowing down, really. So I would be quite adamant about not working too much time. And if I was going to, if I wanted to go off to a festival, Glastonbury Festival, then I went. Well, some of my friends stayed behind because they felt more guilty. But I was like, no, I'm going to go and enjoy myself. So I was actually, wasn't too bad with that. But, you know, I did work a lot. I didn't really have a wife at the time or children or anything. So, and I did love what I did. So I did put a lot of time in. But no, I was very conscious of not overworking myself, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And that was something that was really important when we started Media Molecule. You know, we were very adamant we're not going to have this crunch culture. You know, people need to have, you've got to have a balance in your life with these kind of things. And it actually ends up being, you end up being much more productive, I would argue, when you've got a more balanced life like that.
Yeah. Do you feel like that worked out okay, having that mission? I feel like every studio is going to have that mission starting out of like, yeah, over here, we don't believe in crunch. And then you either succeed or you don't, but you feel like you pulled it off by and large?
Yeah, no, I think we were pretty good, really. Okay. I mean, it's inevitable towards the end of a deadline, there's going to be a bit of extra work and stuff, but and there might be people that you find who worked at Media Molecule, like, oh, that Mark, he doesn't know what he's talking about. He was just off having fun while we were all crunching or something.
I
think we were pretty good. And lots of us were starting to have families and things like that, and we were very conscious of people needing to be able to spend time with their families and things. So no, I think we were pretty good, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I tried booting up Ragdoll Kung Fu earlier this morning on Steam, and I couldn't get it up and running. But it's cool that it's still up there, man.
Yeah, no, I tried myself recently, actually, and I was like, it doesn't work, which is probably really bad. But and even worse is I can't remember how to log in to that account.
Oh, no.
Because I've probably got about 10 different Steam accounts because, you know, obviously the Ragdoll Kung Fu was, I think it was one of, if not the first game on Steam, which is...
Indie game.
Yeah, the first non-Valve game, if you like, the first third-party game. So I was a bit of a guinea pig when they were sort of setting up various things. So I remember at the time going through about 3 or 4 different accounts for various reasons. And, I think it was about 2 years ago, I should really try and log in there and sort this thing out, because they sent me an email saying that they couldn't pay me royalties anymore. Because I was still getting royalties up until a few years ago, not much, like $100 a year or something. But sure. But I had to fill in like an American tax form, a W-8BN or something, I think it's called. And I just tried to log in and I got locked out of my account and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, sod it, I can't be bothered. I'll just leave it. So it's... But, you know, I wanted to just log in and just make it free, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, you were the first, indie game on Steam. You think you could call up Gabe at this point. Someone at Valve can help you out for, like, logging into that old account, right?
I did. I sent a message through the normal channels, if you like, their community managing things.
You're never going to hear back. Oh, you actually heard back?
I got a thing back saying, oh, yeah, you need to do this, that, and the other. And I think I did it and got it wrong, and I was locked out even more or something.
Jesus. Come, take this in spirit, which is intended. Your Steam history. Somebody at Valve, please, help Mark Healy out. Because that could be so cool.
Yeah, please, maybe I can sort that out when I finish my next project.
Yeah, it could be so cool to have that on the same account as Ragdoll Kung Fu on there.
Yeah, exactly.
That seems.
I mean, I've the Steam account that I use now for playing games is working, but that's completely unconnected to the one that Ragdoll Kung Fu is on. So,
Your history with the Valve, I'm really curious about it because I was learning more about The Room, which is confusing. It was a game that you and some other folks were making back in 2005, not the mobile game The Room, which wasn't that also made in Guildford?
Yeah, yeah. That's an old friend of mine and some people that I used to work with, a guy called Barry Mead and a bunch of people that used to work at Criterion, actually, but I knew Barry from working at Bullfrog. Whether that was inspired by the thing that we did or not, I don't know.
But sure.
I would argue it probably was because it had a similar sort of vibe and aesthetic, but maybe that's coincidence.
Right. So
it wasn't really a game, though, but the thing that we did wasn't a game. It was more of a tech demo, really. That was that was with Alex Evans. You know, he was the technical director that co-founded Media Molecule with, who was and still is, you know, complete genius, basically. And all the rendering stuff that he was doing at the time is pretty standard now, but at the time it was, you know, pretty futuristic, really, ahead of its time. So it was just an excuse for him to sort of show off his graphical and programming chops. And we got on really well. And I was the artist for him, basically. So I was putting in lots of ideas there. And we did this very trippy, self-indulgent kind of tech demo, really, that, to give Peter credit, he just let us, he let us go off into a room and just go, just make something cool, essentially.
And own it.
Oh, well, it would have turned into a Lionhead project eventually, I suppose. And I think they probably used it at least to sort of show to, you know, potential investors at the time to show off that, look, this is how cool our tech department is or something. But there wasn't really a clear game there that we were making. It was just sort of, let's just indulge ourselves and make something up as we go along. You know?
So I heard that Valve was interested in picking up The Room, though. That's the part where I was confused about, like, it wasn't a Lionhead project, or was it something independent?
Because that was round about the same time that I made Ragdoll Kung Fu. So I'd already had obviously had some conversations, and I went to Seattle to meet Gabe Newell and the team to talk about Ragdoll Kung Fu. And I think I showed them, or was it me? Did I go with Alex or something? I can't remember but I ended up showing them a little bit of that demo anyway. And they were obviously really excited about that. And they wanted to, it wasn't so much that they wanted to take on that project. I think it was more that they wanted to ask me, Alex, and another guy called Dave, who is also another co-founder of Media Molecule, who was one of the people that made that demo. They were interested in just hiring us as a sort of, as a threesome, if you like, to come and do some cool stuff at Valve. And it's interesting that they went on to do Portal, obviously, which some of the ideas in there existed in our demo. And our demo was much cooler, I would argue. The portals in our demo were amazing, actually. Really trippy. But like I said, it wasn't actually a game. It was just a demo, really.
Right. So it was kind of some portal tech going through windows and paintings and stuff like that. And so what can you figure out the chronology of how that all worked? Like, was it a matter of just Valve was interested in portal tech, or did the team behind Narbacular Drop see The Room demo?
I don't actually know. I mean, I suspect the reality is that game was already in existence or was already in development, I think. And so it might be, you know, maybe they saw that and they could see that that was relevant somehow to that thing that was happening. Completely don't actually know. I'm just guessing now. But I don't think it was a case of like, oh, they saw that and they were like, wow, that's a cool idea. Let's make a game. Yeah. I don't think it was like that.
Sure. Why'd you say no to Gabe?
It was, it was kind of, it was a close shave, actually, because we did, initially I went to Seattle on my own after they saw Ragdoll Kung Fu. So I got invited to GDC based on the strength of Ragdoll Kung Fu, something that I'd put online. And I went to this thing called the Experimental Games Workshop and turned up there, showed the game to, a room of people. And some people from Valve were actually in the audience, and they approached me afterwards. And they were like, we're going to start putting third-party games on Steam. We'd like you to be first game based on what we've seen. you know, I didn't even know what Steam was at the time or who Gabe knew or was or anything. So I've always been in a bit of a bubble. But Alex was with me at the time and he's like, that's Gabe Newell, man. He's one of the original dudes from Microsoft. He's big news. You've got to say yes, go and see these people. So I was like, yeah, cool. So I got on a plane the next day to Seattle and met with, met Gabe and get the name of the guy that I actually dealt with, Doug. Yeah. Doug Lombardi, Doug Lombardi, I think it was. Yeah, I think it was. And they offered me a contract on the spot. They were like, right, we'll give you some money up front if we agree to put the game on Steam. And I was like, awesome. Slightly scared because I was like, I've got to finish this thing now. But so that was my sort of first introduction to Valve. But then maybe a month later, something like that, they invited us all over again, but with Alex and Dave, because they're interested in us as a sort of team, I suppose. And they, you know, they sort of wined and dined us and sort of they put our chaperone was, God, I'm so bad with names, but the dude that did Gollum in Lord of the Rings.
Andy Serkis.
No. Yeah. Not Andy Serkis. Not the actor, sorry. The guy that actually did the CG model of it.
Oh, I don't know his name.
No. There's a guy that did a lot of the sort of tech and actually modelled Gollum was working at Valve at the time. And, you know, he was really trying to entice us to go over there, saying how amazing it was. And, yeah, it did look really exciting. So that was, you know, we even had our contracts ready to sign. We were going to go over there, but it was kind of that or go and do our own thing, go and start our own company, Media Molecule, and we chose to do that instead, essentially.
Wow, just for the spirit of independence and piracy. Yeah.
You know, I think the reality is I probably wouldn't have wanted to move to America, actually. Not because I dislike America, but it's just I'm a bit of a, you know, I like living in England. I've got my family and my friends, and that's a bit too scary to go and move to another country for me at the time. So, we rented our own thing.
So there's a universe where you guys weren't so partial to England and said, yeah, let's go for Valve. And then you would have made some Portal game and derailed the Portal from ever developing and maybe made Little Big Planet as a Valve property as the follow-up to Half-Life 2. Like, what a weird world.
Who knows? Yeah, I mean, I think the, if I remember rightly, Gary's Mod was sort of a thing at the time or in its infancy or something. I've got a feeling that might have been what we went on to, because, you know, we did talk, even though we hadn't formed Media Molecule, we were very into this idea of user generated content and that sort of stuff. So I guess that would have been a natural fit at the time. Who knows?
Yeah. Just to jump ahead a little bit then, Little Big Planet started out called Craft World. Yellowhead was the star of that whole thing. What was that courting process like? You're making this funky project. Who was knocking on your door to try and sign you up?
So how that all came about really was that room demo that we were doing at Lionhead was basically myself, Alex, Dave Smith, and Kareem Atuni. All in a room together, just doing that. So we had our own little mini universe going on, if you like. But we knew that it was going to be time to move on. We were either going to go and start a company or go to Valve, whatever. And Lionhead was going through a lot of crazy things at the time. I think they were about to float on the stock market or something like this. And I don't know, stuff that went over my head, but it was a bit of a weird time. Basically, an old friend of ours who worked at Sony at the time, Pete, he basically got in touch with Alex and said, look, I've got you an interview. I've got you a meeting with Phil Harrison next week. You can go and pitch something if you like. And we were like, okay, that's cool. But what are we going to pitch? And it was, Dave had, for some time, had been working on this like 2D physics engine, this personal project that could handle lots of different objects all sort of colliding off each other nicely and all this kind of stuff. So we sort of basically decided, right, let's use that and take some of what we've learned from Ragdoll Kung Fu, believe it or not, with the sort of fact that you can sort of perform and act with your characters. sort of munged that together somehow into what became the Yellowhead demo, really, which was the main, you know, that was that, all the coding on that was Dave, by the way. And then me and Alex sort of injected our various bits and bobs, and we ended up turning that into a sort of a presentation, if you like, of, we thought, we're not going to go to Phil Harrison with a PowerPoint presentation. We know that he sees a million of those every day and it's really boring. So we actually built like a whole little presentation within this, you know, Dave's physics. I can't remember what he called it at the time, but that's what became the Yellowhead demo essentially. But we put it together really quickly. It was literally in about the space of a week or something. And, you know, Phil Harrison was basically tempted or blown away enough to sort of agree to fund us for like 6 months to turn it into something else. So that's what we did. We got some money for 6 months and went off and did the, well, you know, it slowly became what we showed at GDC, the first Little Big Planet demo thing.
So was that Sony kind of locking it down as this is a Sony project now because of this funding?
Well, obviously, because we took money off them, you know, that was it. Well, actually, I say that. The funny thing is, we actually didn't have anything in writing to say that we were actually going to continue with them, or that they even owned what we were doing. It's my memory of it. And actually, I do remember after we showed, I think it was it after we showed the thing at GDC? Or before, someone from Microsoft actually was on the prowl, and they were actually quite, you know, they were kind of trying to steal us, if you like, from within, you know, with going with Sony. And technically we could have done, we could have been like, yeah, f- it, let's go with Microsoft. They're going to probably give us a load of money or whatever. But that felt very wrong and morally corrupt. So obviously we didn't do that. But
how serious was that? Was it just like a conversation in a bar of like, hey, you guys?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't actually outright say that. They were just sort of like, I always want to meet you guys, you know. I can't remember who it was that came down to Guildford to meet us, but we went out and got a bit drunk. And it was literally just as we were dropping the guy off at his hotel, he kind of like, he was like, but I was on a mission here, I've got to at least say something. And he was just like, oh, yeah, by the way, guys, you know, we'd be happy to blah, 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 take you on if you want to jump ship to us or something like that. You know, it's like, and you could tell he was almost embarrassed to say it, actually, because it was, it would have been a very naughty thing to do. And obviously we didn't, because, you know, we're nice people. And yeah, we were, you know, very grateful that Sony sort of gave us that chance. So
yeah. In an alternate universe, if that guy stayed sober and had a great pitch, it's possible Little Big Planet would have been a Microsoft project.
No, okay. No. Okay. No. I mean, you know, the fact that they'd funded it, I'm probably talking nonsense, to be honest with you, but I'm sure they must have had, there must have been some legal thing in place to say that they owned it. I'm sure there must have been, but when I reminisce with Alex, that's how he tells it, and he does have a habit of sort of rewriting history a little bit sometimes. So
everybody does, yeah.
Yeah, but no, you know, that would never have happened. You know, we'd already built up a good relationship with the people we were working with at Sony and stuff, yeah. So it was just a done deal, really. But
nice. Is it bizarre to see Little Big Planet continue on? I mean, is it surreal to look at a game like Sackboy's Big Adventure from a couple of years ago and just be like, what is this?
Well, yeah, no, it's I mean, the thing that blows me away is how long ago it all was that we did Little Big Planet, actually, because yeah, time, especially, you know, when, as you get older, like to my age, time kind of speeds up, essentially. And in my mind, yeah, that was the game that I did a few years ago, but I meet so many people, you know, and then when they learn that I helped make Little Big Planet, they're like, oh my God, that was the game that I loved when I was a small child growing up, you know, and I'm talking to a fully grown adult and I'm like, this is like old history now, you know. So that's kind of weird. But it's, you know, it's great that it did sort of get a life of its own, if you like, and the flame was carried on by Sumo and all those people. So yeah, no, it was really cool, and still a lot of people, you know, have a soft spot for Sackboy and all that. It's obviously quite sad recently that the servers got shut down or whatever it was. I don't actually know the specifics of that and why and when, but obviously that hurt a lot of people in the community, I think.
Yeah.
So that sort of made me feel a bit sad, if you like. I'd like to think that they're going to at least archive that off or something like that. I don't really know. But,
well, it's a weird thing where they said, like, oh, we're temporarily taking it down in January. And then and then they just said, actually, it's going to stay offline forever. So I don't know if anybody, I don't know if that diminished the chances of kind of saving some of that content that was in Little Big Planet 3.
Yeah, I've got no idea. But there's a lot of content in there. And, you know, I mean, I'm not sure of the technicalities of it, but it's, you know, the size of external hard drives that you can buy today, I'm sure it would probably all fit on two or three of those or something. So it's not like it needs, you know, the Pentagon or something to store it all. So, but like I said, I don't know. I've got no idea what the reasons are behind all of that, but it does feel a bit sad to me that, you know, there's a lot of memories that people have got with all of that and that sort of thing. And I can't help feeling it would sort of destroy a little bit of faith, if you like, and people wanting to sort of commit and put time into those kind of things again in the future. You know, I feel like that's a bit of a, who knows? I don't know, but that I felt the pain. I felt the collective pain when that news hit, which is quite sad.
Yeah. It's kind of a 1-2 punch too. I don't know if you saw that Nintendo, filed a cease and desist for all their stuff that's in Garry's Mod as well. So Garry's Mod has been stripping out all Nintendo stuff, but I mean, there must be a world you're familiar with. Did you ever get like a poke from Nintendo or Microsoft? Be like, hey, a lot of these Dreams games are just a Banjo-Kazooie. Could you do something about that?
Yeah. I don't know. I was always a bit separated from that kind of stuff. No doubt there probably was some stuff, but I mean, because Dreams never got really huge, like, you know, it wasn't like Roblox or something like that.
Right.
Maybe if it had got to that kind of size, there would have been a lot more of that, but maybe because it was a bit more in the fringes, they were sort of like, we'll tolerate that for now, or maybe they weren't even aware, who knows?
Yeah.
But there was some sort of, you know, I mean, even now I still see, I forget the name of the developer now, is it... Elker, I think his name is, a Dreams user. He's been doing like a fan-made avatar game.
Oh, awesome.
For lots of time. And I think the people that actually made Avatar got in touch with him, and they sort of endorsed it, actually, and kind of encouraged him to carry on with it. So that was a sort of opposite of that, if you like.
Yeah.
For that kind of thing.
Oh, that's so sweet. I wanted to ask, Little Big Planet Hub, the kind of free-to-play version of Little Big Planet, was that a Media Molecule joint? I know it never saw the light of day.
I knew nothing about that. I think that was post us, sort of, you know, we did Little Big Planet 2 and then kind of moved on to do some other stuff. And some people at Sony were sort of running with it. I think it came from that universe.
Okay.
So I wasn't, I had no knowledge of that.
That's so odd. Did I see this online somewhere that you originally thought about making the first Little Big Planet free to play? Was that a consideration at any point?
That was probably talked about, I imagine. I imagine that probably would have been something that Alex was probably more vocal about, because I felt like he always lived in the future more than any of us, you know, and he could probably see that sort of thing coming down the line. But no, I don't think that was ever really seriously considered that I know of.
Yeah.
No.
It must have been exciting wrapping up Little Big Planet 2. Is that just the sweet spot of game development of like, all right, let's get prototyping. We could go anywhere, baby.
Well, you know, I mean, obviously that basic concept of sort of empowering communities to make their own games and share stuff with each other was a big driving force behind Dreams.
Yeah.
At one point I was actually pushing for Dreams to kind of be a continuation of the Little Big Planet franchise, really, as in, you know, I would like to have called it Little Big Planet 3, really, or 4 or something, and had Sackboy as a central character in it, because I was certainly aware of how important Sackboy and the game that we put in there in Little Big Planet was a big part of his success. Not obviously the creators were the thing that gave it its long life, but without Sackboy, I don't think it would have happened, you know. So I was quite aware that it was important to have something like that, really, but I wasn't that pushy about it, and it kind of got talked down by various people for whatever reason. So
it seems bizarre. You're supposed to be the artist on the team that's saying, let's create something new. We don't need some mascot to sell this thing, but suddenly you're the corporate man. I'm like, well, you got to slap Sackboy on this thing.
Yeah, well, no, I don't know. I was just aware that you know, that Sackboy had hit touched a lot of people for whatever reasons. Like my mum, even my mum adored Sackboy, and she knows nothing about computer games or anything. And I was just aware that that was actually a big part of Little Big Planet's success, not all of the stuff that it sort of gave it its long tail and all that kind of stuff. And I just felt like, why would we not do that kind of thing? So, but I wasn't that passionate about it. It wasn't a big idea that I pushed and got knocked down. It was more like I mentioned it a few times. Don't you think we should do this? And people are like, no, we want it to have its own identity, this new thing. So
it's Sony people or Media Molecule people?
No, that was more internal, okay. More internal within Media Molecule, really. But because you know, although I had the title of creative director at the time, it was actually quite a flat structure, really. Sure. You know, there was not. I was definitely never one to sort of pull rank or anything like that. I just felt like I was working with people. It wasn't that I had a team of people working for me or anything like that. So yeah, I wasn't trying not to be too pushy with that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I visited Media Molecule in 2018 for the Game Informer cover story trip on Dreams there. Okay. I remember it was like, you guys were so excited. Naturally, the project was nearing the finish line. And it was the whole idea in that phase of like, I think we can have like a dream section on the PlayStation Store where people can create their own stuff and then sell their own stuff. And then we could get a cut of that. And then that'd be the golden ticket for us forever. How close was that to seeing the light of day?
I don't think it ever came close, really. I mean, that was certainly something that myself and Kareem were really into.
Yeah.
And in fact, we used to refer to it as the golden ticket, as in, you know, we loved the idea that the best creations in Dreams, if you like, could be plucked out and actually, you know, sold on the PSN store as standalone games, essentially. Right. And certainly the tech for Dreams was built to be able to do that. But for whatever reasons, it wasn't a goer, which I felt was a shame, really, because there were some things in Dreams that appeared that I felt like, you know, did deserve to exist in their own right, mm-hmm. outside of that kind of ecosystem.
And it's just the legal framework kind of bogged it down?
Yeah, I mean, we had so many discussions and meetings about how to monetize and get some sort of, you know, we used to record them kickbacks, if you'd like, but a way for creators to make money from their creations and in similar ways that Roblox do and all this kind of stuff. But there's so many legal hurdles and stuff that would just, you know, make you want to shoot yourself in 3 seconds, really. It's because I think there was some weird legal thing, you know, because we're like, why can't we just do what Roblox do, for example?
Right.
And we're like, well, we can't because something to do with Roblox being an American company and they can do what they're doing, but elsewhere in the world, that's illegal or I don't know. Talking beyond my knowledge now, but there was lots of weird things that just Sony couldn't do for some legal reasons, was my understanding of it.
I mean, obviously, I don't know the first thing about any of this stuff, but it just seems like if you've invested so many years of development into Dreams, you're looking at the success of Roblox. Obviously, now maybe it'd be a different story, but I don't know. This is 2016, 2015. I don't know when these discussions are really at their peak. Like, you think Sony would just move heaven and earth for like, if we could have a slice of that Roblox pie? Clearly, this is where the future is going. It's amazing that they weren't willing to invest to make that part happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be fair, I mean, they did support us for a long time.
Oh, yeah, with Dreams. Yeah. It's wild, yeah.
And I think there probably was there must have been a desire to do that somehow. And there was certainly a lot of exploration and efforts put into that kind of stuff. But for whatever reasons, certain things hit dead ends and stuff that I couldn't even begin to understand, you know. But it's a shame that that didn't really sort of happen, I suppose, because I think it could have been a very different story with Dreams, actually. But, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. I remember you guys were also saying like, oh, there's actually another external studio that's developing a VR game in Dreams right now that'll be released on the store. And whatever happened with that?
Oh, yeah, I can't remember, actually. I've got vague memories of the actual game. It was a team in Brighton. I forget their name now. But, that just kind of fizzled out for whatever reason.
Oh, that's so frustrating. How bizarre.
Yeah, I don't know what actually happened there.
Yeah.
Again, I wasn't that involved with that, really. I just remember seeing a little bit of some of the early demos, but
sure. Looking back on Dreams, such an incredible project, is it warm feelings? Is it frustration? What's the overall sensation for you looking back on that thing?
We were so lucky to allow it to be indulged in such a crazy project, really. So I'm incredibly grateful, really, to all the people that allowed that to happen. I loved, at the time, it was Michael Denny was our main contact at Sony in terms of sort of supporting us, and Shuey was a big part of all of that as well. So there was a lot of mutual respect there. I've got lots of fond memories of all of that. And, you know, had some good times. It's amazing that we made it happen at all, really. I think for that thing to exist on a console was... So I'm just... I can't have any frustration or bitterness about it, if I'm honest. You know, I'm glad that it happened, really. And although, you know, it didn't go on to be the Roblox killer or the Fortnite metaverse thing that they seem to be doing very well at, I think a lot of people have gone on, a lot of people that use Dreams and even Little Big Planet have gone on to do various cool careers because of it. And a lot of people always get in touch with me how inspiring it was for what they're doing now in their particular field of stuff. So no, it was good. I think it was a force for good. It had an impact in its own way, I would argue. And one thing that fascinates me now actually is there's a guy called Martin Nebelong. He was a big user of Dreams, and actually he was someone that we hired as a sort of evangelist, if you like, of the tool. So he got very good at it. And he still now evangelizes it, even though he's not paid to do that by anyone. And he's massively into AI as well. And he uses Dreams loads with like an AI layer on top of it to sort of, he's like, this is the future, man. Dreams like tools of an AI. Like, so he's kind of carrying the torch forward. And I've actually had, you know, quite a few people get in touch with me from AI startups and things that are interested in getting me involved, but I've sort of resisted. But so it's definitely had a bit of an inspirational impact on tools and game dev as a whole, I would say. So so, you know, I have to be very grateful to have been a part of that, really. I can't be sad or frustrated about that. It's cool.
Yeah, for sure. What do you miss about Mini Molecule?
What do I miss? Lunch times. We had
okay.
We had a couple of full-time chefs. Ooh. That used to prepare lovely meals for everyone at lunchtime. That's nice. I would say the people, but I still see those people. I still mix with a lot of them. I saw a bunch of them last night down the pub, in fact. So I still get to have that, really. So no, I don't think there's anything that I miss, really. You know, it was nice having a fat salary. That was good.
Oh, congratulations on the fat salary over there.
But, you know, there's more to life than money, isn't there? And, you know, I'm okay. I can survive a few years without that. So, no, nothing that I miss, really. Just, nothing. The car parking space was handy because it was in the middle of Guildford, so I could go and park for free. That was quite handy.
That's right, but you're feeling good about where you're at now.
Yeah, no, totally. I'm, to be honest with you, when I did initially leave and the circumstances around that, I was sad for a little bit. Took me a while to process it and all that kind of stuff. But now I'm so happy that things happened the way they did, actually, because, I mean, it just feels right. You know, it was the universe saying, right, it's time for you to do something different and be in a different place, and feels right. I'm really happy.
Okay, so it was a stressful, cool, traumatic ending, but now...
No, it wasn't ideal for me. You know, I'd like it to have been a slightly happier ending than that, but...
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't go into it too much, but it's... Yeah, it was... I was sad for a little bit because it was a big part of my life, you know, 17 years. You know, so it's like ending a marriage or something, you know. Even if it's voluntary, you're still going to have sort of feelings and things to process that take a while to actually surface and sink in, lots of weird dreams and all this kind of stuff. But
how appropriate.
But no, it's, yeah, but yeah, no, I'm really, I'm much, so much happier now. than I was. So.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say? Anything about your history you're dying to talk about that I didn't happen to ask?
No, not really. Not that I can think of. I still love it. Still love doing it. That's the main thing.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I've still got something to offer. So, and whether I have or not, I'm still going to do it anyway because it's just what it's what I know. It's what I've always done. It's what I love doing. So, and I'm just really grateful that I've had the opportunities that I've had really to do what I've done. And yeah, fantastic. And it's so much easier now to make a game than it used to be.
Yeah.
With things like Unity and Unreal and Godot and all these other engines and things. I love it. It's all good. Slightly sad that there's a lot, been so many sort of layoffs recently in the industry. But I don't know what to say about that. I mean, when you've been in the industry as long as I have, there's been cycles of that essentially, and it just does feel a bit almost natural that happens. That's not much consolation to someone that's just lost their job, obviously. But I would say if you're really passionate about what you do and you love it, hang in there. There'll be other flowers that pop up that you can go and be a part of and all that sort of thing. So stick at it.
Right on.
It's all good.
Well, hey, Mark, thanks for your time, man. Thanks for unpacking your whole career one more time.
Yeah, well, I can't believe that you enticed my mad breakdown episode out of me. I wasn't really planning to talk about that, but it's been nice talking to you.
Yeah. You feel like that period of your life kind of defined the second half of your career? Do you still feel like you have a shifted perspective from that period?
I delve in and out of it, absolutely. Yeah, it's been the main driving force of my life, actually, if I'm really honest with you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Without wanting to sound like some kind of David Icke type character, it's a big part of my of what I do and why I do it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hey, you want to play some Pink Floyd to send us out or anything here?
I would have done if I'd had some time to practice, but no, I'm not gonna torture your viewers with any of that.
Okay. Well, that seems fair. But hey, Mark, stay in touch about that project, and please, Valve, reach out, get it on the same account as Ragdoll Kung Fu. That'd be so cool.
Oh, yeah, that'd be really nice actually to sort that mess out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome.
Great. Well, hey, thank you so much, Mark. Thanks so much, everybody, for watching or listening to this interview from MinMax. You can always subscribe to MinMax's YouTube channel to find a ton more interviews like it and help support independent games media. We appreciate it. Or if you really enjoyed this interview and you help sharing it, it's appreciated. Or you can go to patreon.com/minmax with two N's and unlock the podcast version of all of our interviews moving forward and a ton of other goodies. But all right, thanks so much, everybody. See you next time. Bye.
Awesome.